The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 145.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, one of my good buddies from down under, Mr. Martin North with DFA Analysts. Martin, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Hello, George. How are you going?
I'm doing real well. Now, I've done a few videos lately on the housing market here in the United States, and I've got some kind of outside of the box ideas. And I know the housing market is all the talk in Australia. So let's start with the Aussie housing market. Every single time I talk to you, it seems it gets crazier and crazier and crazier. And I was just on your channel prior to calling you on Skype, and I saw that you've interviewed some mortgage brokers there in Australia. So I'd love to get all the feedback that you're getting from the boots on the ground research you do.
Yeah, it's really amazing. Look, I don't know whether you've ever come across the Alice in Wonderland, right?
Oh, book,
But I actually think Alice in Wonderland is the best analogy to the property market, right? Because basically anything can happen and it's not, you know, a normal situation at all. The world is not normal, right? That's my ultimate conclusion.
Yeah, well, I did a lot of LSD in high school, so that's kind of the same thing, right?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. So talking caterpillars and all the rest, nothing. I mean, you know, that the housing market here is, well, it's talk of the town, of course, because it's such a large part of the economy. And I'll just give you a sort of a few indicators of what's happened recently. I mean, the top level news is that despite all the spin and the hype and all of the mainstream media talking about auction rates are really high and everything, the truth is the market is still relatively on the decline. Prices are sliding in some areas, sliding sideways in others and going up in just a few areas. But what really is interesting is how the government and the Reserve Bank and our regulators are backing the housing market as the growth engine once again to take us out of the economic slowdown from COVID, which of course was happening already. So I keep saying that the virus was a catalyst for something which was already there. So on Friday of last week, the Treasurer announced that as at next March, they're planning to take away what are called the responsible lending rules. Now, responsible lending was brought in after the global financial crisis in Australia because there was a sense that there was an unequal relationship between borrowers and lenders, and that lenders basically were able to throw loans at people and they just sort of gobbled them up, right, without any real accountability.
But isn't that what's going on right now?
So responsible lending came in, right? And of course, we had a Royal Commission into the financial sector 2 or 3 years ago, and the Royal Commission spun a spotlight on poor behavior in the financial system around mortgages. So mortgage brokers were fiddling with applications, encouraging applicants to lie. The banks were actually throwing out loans they should never have thrown out. And during that process and after that process, lending momentum eased and property price growth eased, right? And then slowly it's been turning up. And now we've got the situation where that core protection from a consumer perspective, it's just being taken away. March next year is the proposed. Now, the argument from the government is, one, the financial regulator on financial stability has now put more pressure on the banks in terms of portfolio management of their mortgage portfolio. So the risk management processes should be stronger, right? Two, this was all red tape. It was unnecessary. All of this validation of incomes and all those things was unnecessary. And three, it swung the pendulum completely back to the consumer. In other words, if the consumer makes a declaration about their income or makes a declaration about their ability to be able to service the loan, the bank can just take it. They don't have to do any more due diligence, right? This is a remarkable turnaround, and this is yet another signal that the markets here are not logical at all, right? That basically they want to use the housing sector and more debt to try and pull the economy out of the deep doo-doo it's in. And remember, of course, that we've got some of the highest debt-to-income ratios in the world. Yeah. We've got a third of the population leveraged to the gills, and the mortgage stress numbers that I look at are as high as they've ever been. So it's not like we're starting from a nice, clean starting point. So this is another example of short-termism, housing market, and, of course, over the weekend, all of those property portals in Australia then were actually saying, hey, whoopee, you know, the market's going to come back and everyone's going to be, you know, absolutely buoyant about the property. No, actually, it's not like that. And I'll tell you a bit more about that. But look, that's just the sort of the headline big change that happened literally last Friday.
But are the banks keeping these loans on their books or are they selling them?
Some are at the margin securitizing them, but mostly they are kept on the books. And the default rates have been very low. So in Australia, you know, a typical default rate, 90-day, is, you know, well under 1%. And it's only upticked very slightly. And, of course, the banks then say, well, you know, there's nothing to see here.
Now, yeah, that's pushback.
Yeah, but the point is we have full recourse here in Australia, right? And that's really important to understand. So if you actually take a loan and later you have difficulty with that loan and, you know, you want to unwind it, as it were, even if you sell the property, repay the bank, and you still owe money at the end of it, that loan stays with you. So that balance stays with you. So it's full recourse, right? And that's something that people have, you know, missed in some of these conversations. Compare it, for example, in some areas of the US where you can just hand the keys back and say cheers, right? Can't do that here, right? The loan stays with you. And the other point to the other point to make is that if you look at the distribution of the credit, right? Like I said, it's one third of the population who are basically mortgage holders. It's not equally spread. There are a lot of people with, you know, reasonable mortgages and, you know, frankly, not too many issues. Okay, unemployment's getting higher. There are risks there. But there's another group, what I call the marginal borrowers, who are borrowing to the gills, have essentially very little ability to be able to handle any additional financial crises. And these are the people who are seeing their incomes dissipating thanks to the latest issues with regard to the economy. And they're cutting back on their spending and trying to make things meet. But because of the way that this all runs in Australia and the underlying conviction that property can only ever go up, which is still there, wired into consumer land, right? People hang on and hang on and hang on by their fingertips, hoping that things are going to magically turn around. And that's where I think we're going to find it difficult down the track. So the banks are fine, I think. You know, the government can say, well, you know, we can just throw more money at this and lift house prices again and get more debt. But the marginal borrower is the one I'm concerned about.
I'm trying to think this through. Do you guys do the cash out refis there?
Yeah, they can refinance, and there's a big bounce on refinancing recently because, of course, rates came down quite significantly. So that, you know, that you can get a mortgage for two point something, whereas it used to be 3 or 4. And a lot of fixed rate deals are very, very cheap at the moment because of the fact that the Reserve Bank is controlling the yield curve, and as a result of that, the actual rate that you pay is quite low. A lot of people, though, when they refinance, used to pull equity out as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Just using that as an ATM like we did.
Yeah. And we saw that over the last 10 to 15 years, particularly strong because, of course, equity was expanding. Even now, some of the refinancing that is going on is still pulling equity out, right? And that's one of the reasons why the total value of loans made in Australia is rising. The other one, of course, is that about 15% of mortgages at the moment have a deferred principal and interest repayment. This was brought in because of the issues with regard to COVID. And what that means is that they aren't making any payments at all at the moment, right? And that's been going on for about 6 months. And so the value to the banks of those mortgages is rising because they're capitalizing the interest, right? And now the banks are starting to have to speak to each of these borrowers and say, can you please start repaying? And interestingly, one of the banks said the other day that 1 in 5 of people on deferred mortgages haven't picked up the phone when the bank's called. They're ghosting the bank, right? They don't want to talk about starting to remake their payments. And interestingly, if you look at the analysis there, there's about a quarter of people who will be able to start, probably no issues. Another quarter at the other end of the spectrum who just have got no job now, so no income. So they've got a major issue, right? And 50% in the middle who will be able to do something. Maybe they'll be switched to an interest-only loan or something like that, which, by the way, has its own situation. But here's the thing. The regulators basically have shifted that goalpost out now to say, well, you can go on forgiving repayments up until, let's say, March next year, right? Originally it was 6 months. Now it's a lot longer. And secondly, those loans are not classified as bad loans, right? So from
on the balance sheet.
On the balance sheet, right? Yeah, so they can just be classified as normal loans. And every time you have a reset event with the client, that puts the loan back to normal status again. So basically, this is what I call the extend and pretend situation that we're in. And by the way, 19% of SMEs who are borrowing are also on deferred repayments at the moment. So, you know, this is a really, really big sleeping issue. And, you know, the banks have actually started lifting their provisions because they do expect more bad debts ahead. And of course, if the loans are actually provided for by way of bad loans, then suddenly the amount of capital the banks have to hold goes through the roof. So the regulators don't want that. The banks don't want that. So they're sort of, you know, extending and pretending, hoping that things will magically work. So we're in this amazing situation where we've got a pool of people who are deferred on their mortgages. We've got rising unemployment, as we've discussed, you know, in our last show, 10% by the end of the year, the RBA says, 7% 2 years later, which is much higher than it used to be. And that's the real number in the official figures. The real number, the unofficial figures, is probably close to 15%. And we got all of these other things that are going on below the waterline to try and protect the banking system. Final point. The Reserve Bank has been providing liquidity directly to the banks. So they've been controlling the interest rate by doing that. So there's a flow there. And now the Reserve Bank has also said that they're going to encourage, quote unquote, the banks to start buying state bonds and government bonds to be able to actually further enhance the liquidity of the banks, right? And the question I have is, well, all that enhanced liquidity, is it going to go anywhere? Because if people are actually under the pressures that we think they're under, they may not be able to afford it. So we've got this magic money machine called the housing sector, right? And they're just throwing more and more fuel on the flames at the moment. And I'm just amazed at where we're going.
What is the home ownership rate there, as far as a percentage of the population?
Yeah, so basically you can think of it like a third, a third, a third of households, right? So one third of households have property with a mortgage, right? One third of people have property without any mortgage, so they own it free and home. And one third of the population are actually renting, right? And what's happened over the last 20 or 30 years is that the proportion of a home free is dropping, and the proportion that's got a mortgage and the proportion that are renting are both rising. And actually, statistically speaking, as you move into older age and retirement now, a greater proportion of people than ever before are retiring still with a mortgage on their property, right? And then they get the income shock when, of course, suddenly they stop working and they've still got to make a mortgage repayment. Now, of course, the argument always was, well, you know, capital appreciation will save us because basically the property prices always go up, don't they? And that means that there's going to be a big pool of equity, and that means that I can repay the mortgage later when I want to. But if my modeling is correct and the forward projections on home prices are actually much less strong than people expect, then they're going to have a lot of nasty surprises. And we're already seeing some of that. So some of those people who actually hold those mortgages into retirement, I call them the down traders, when they come to try and sell, what they're discovering is that the value of their property is now lower than they thought it was. They don't have enough money to be able to repay the mortgage, buy something smaller, and maintain something for retirement. So that's another factor in the mix.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like this powder keg. I'm trying to play devil's advocate and think about, okay, how could they create additional financial engineering to continue to kick the can down the road so we can get all these cross currents in our mind to try to figure out the probabilities of when this bubble is going to pop, because obviously it's a bubble. There's no debating that. There's nothing lasts forever. At some point, it's going to be time to pay the fiddler. It's just a matter of thinking through, okay, is that a month from now? Is that a year from now? Is that 5 years from now? What you were talking about, those fixed rate loans, do you guys do the, I'm assuming the answer is no, but do you guys do the 30-year fixed rate there?
No, mostly it's 3 years or 1 year, 3 years or 5 years, a few 10 years, but hardly any. Mostly people are on variable rates.
So do you think that the banks with the sponsorship of the central bank could come in and like readjust the mortgage to, let's say the central bank drops the rates down, they try to peg that yield curve as low as they possibly can, so get it as close to zero. And if they could get it, let's say it's at 50 basis points a mortgage, and then the banks could come in and say, okay, well, we'll just readjust your loan, or we'll redo the loan to where it's a 30-year fix, or like a 40-year fix, something like that, to drop the payments. And then the central bank comes in and says, okay, well, you can keep the loans on your books, you private banks, but we'll go ahead and backstop, let's say, 95% of losses due to inflation or something like that, if you extend it out from a 20-year fix to, let's say, a 40-year fix or a 50-year fix. I mean, is that something that they might try to pull out of the hat to just continue to kick this can down the road in order to drop the monthly payment and to have it more affordable? And if that monthly payment drops, then the home prices can continue to rise.
Well, we've got an alternative version, and that is the interest-only story, right? So we, through the Royal Commission and post the Royal Commission, there was a very big drive to move people off interest-only loans, because everyone started to realize that you've still got to repay the capital sometime down the road, right? And there was a big drive to move people off interest-only loans towards principal interest loans. And I said over the last couple of years, that is our equivalent of the subprime in the US, right? Now that's completely reversed. So basically the regulators said it's perfectly fine to move people back onto interest-only loans, right? In other words, forget about repaying any capital, just service the interest. And of course, with your interest rates being very low, you know, that payment is very, very low. So that's what's actually happening. So a lot of people are being switched over to interest only. And my perspective is this: they're only thinking about making sure that the cash flow servicing of those loans continues. They're not worried now about repaying capital down the track, right? And I guess if the assumption is if prices continue to go up, there'll be more equity there that we can actually use later. Bit short term, but that's certainly what's there. The other thing I think that the strategy we could see is if there are bad loans, and there probably will be bad loans and bad mortgages, maybe those bad mortgages will be bought off the banks by the central bank. So they basically create a pool of bad loans, as it were, and they're held up. Because what is clearly the number one concern here in Australia is financial stability of the banking system. And that's, everyone is talking about it. The Reserve Bank's talking about it. Our regulator APRA is talking about it. Financial stability means that the banks can continue to provide liquidity, right? Can provide more loans. Now, I've got a question, and that is, at what point are we debted out? At what point is essentially there's so much debt out there that businesses and consumers are just not able and willing to borrow more, right?
And incomes won't sustain the repayments.
Well, it's simply a matter of, there is a point at which you know, no debt is actually really sense, right? If you're a consumer or a business. And there's a couple of observations there. Firstly, it's a question of confidence, right? So you can provide a lot of liquidity to the banks and to the banking system, but if people are not confident about their own financial position and the broader economic scenarios that we're facing, they will probably be unwilling to borrow more, right? In fact, the big observation is that there's been a really big drive to pay down debt over the last few months. And in fact, a lot of the government stimulus packages that were thrown out there through what's called JobKeeper and JobSeeker went to repaying debt. So we're seeing quite a lot of people paying down debt rather than actually taking more debt. So that trend, if it continues, would suggest that just throwing more liquidity at the banks and hoping that they're going to lend more won't necessarily create more economic activity. The second point is that the very people who need the money, and I'm thinking here of particularly the SME sector.
I'm sorry, Martin, can you just define that real quick, just in case someone's not familiar with that term?
So the small and medium enterprise sector. So these are small businesses with, you know, they could be mum and dad businesses or employing a few people. That we've got more than 3 million small and medium enterprise businesses in Australia, of which, frankly, they make up a lot of the economy and has been traditionally one of the economic dynamos of Australia. But they are finding it very difficult to get funding. And in fact, there was a facility offered via the Reserve Bank to the retail banks to offer specific credit to the SME sector. And it was a reasonably large chunk of money that was put aside, but almost none was taken up. And my surveys are suggesting the reason is that SMEs are just not confident about their ability to be able to manage their businesses ahead. And on my surveys, about one third of small businesses, one third, say they may not be around in 6 months. So there is a real big confidence question, right? And some of those, of course, are supporting their businesses on a mortgage on a property. So that's another sort of factor in this Alice in Wonderland world that we're in at the moment.
So they're supporting their business from the appreciation of the commercial building they own for their business.
It's more often secured on their personal property. So it's on the residence. They've got a mortgage, right? And the mortgage is, they're servicing the mortgage, but they're also using some of the equity to support the business. That's particularly very small businesses. That's what they tend to do.
One point that you made there, which is really good, and I think it's a point that's lost often here in the United States with some of the people on FinTwit and whatnot, is they always look at the supply side of lendings. So we talk about the central bank here, the Fed, and them providing enough liquidity to increase the balance sheet capacity for the commercial banks to be able to lend, to create more loans, because that's what creates additional money supply. And that's kind of where you start when you're thinking about the deflation, inflation debate. But what we tend to forget about here, and what I always mention is, hey guys, let's not forget about the demand side of the equation. Just because these banks have, let's just say, infinite lending capabilities, they still have to find people that want to take the loan. It's not just about finding qualified buyers and finding, yes, the banking system nowadays in the modern era, the only limitation they have is to finding additional loan where they think they can actually make money. And sometimes that's not even a barrier. But you have to get people that come to the bank and say, hey, bank, I want to buy another car, or I want to buy a house, or I want to take out a business loan to buy a McDonald's franchise or something. And so you made that point about the demand side of the equation really falling off a cliff. And at some point, if people's incomes can't service a monthly payment, they're levered to the hilt, they're not going to be going back to that bank trying to get another loan to start a business or buy another house, even if the banks want to lend and even if the government wants to force home buying down the throats of every single consumer. So now let's talk about that a little bit, because I know you do a lot of door-to-door surveys in Australia. So from the demand side of the equation, are you seeing appetite decrease with just everyday normal people, or what are you seeing there with your surveys?
Yeah, so if I talked about the business community first and the SMEs in particular, yeah, demand is way off. So essentially, businesses are saying, and it depends obviously by industry. So there have been some that have benefited from the COVID, but a lot haven't. So tourism, very, very much off the boil at the moment. I mean, there's no international tourism. There's a little bit of interstate tourism just starting to open up as they open up the borders. We also know that sort of sector relating to education is going through an absolute disaster at the moment, because we had so many international students here in Australia, none of which, of course, came back, or very few came back. And there were a lot of support entities, and that's everything from individual tutors that were actually employed by the universities or other sectors through to some of the support functions, the technology functions. So a lot of those are actually finding it's now very difficult. We've also got the situation where retail is absolutely falling off a cliff. And what's fascinating about retail is if you look at the statistics, it was all over the place. So we had very strong retail in some sub sectors, very weak retail in other sectors. But it was all to do with home offices and buying a lot of stuff like toilet paper earlier on, right, when we had this crisis. But a lot of retail is now looking very, very sick. We see keep seeing more job losses. We keep seeing more store closures, which, by the way, signals trouble ahead for the commercial sector, which we might talk about in a second. So there is very weak demand across a lot of business sectors with regard to supporting their businesses. And most of them are in what I would say are sort of, you know, hunker down mode, trying to just protect their business. And interestingly, last Thursday, the day before the other announcement, they changed the bankruptcy rules in Australia, because previously, if you were unable to meet your obligations, generally, you handed your business over to an administrator who basically took charge of it, right? Now they've been given a month or so to try and create a new restructuring program and still own the business. If they can get more than 50% of creditors to agree, they can restructure and continue. So they've started to change the bankruptcy, a bit like what's in the US, right? And that's another signal of they recognize this is a major issue. The question is that really going to make any big change? Because one of my observations is in the commercial sector is that once businesses start getting into difficulty, the contagion of their problems spreads to other businesses, other suppliers, right? And so what you discover is that the lines of credit and the lines of stock and supply start getting frozen, and we're already seeing that. So the more you allow businesses who probably shouldn't be trading to trade, you actually build a more systemic structural issue down the track. And that's the concern I'm seeing there. So very little appetite in the SME sector. On the consumer side, personal credit from normal sources, things like credit cards, is way down. So a lot of people are not using those. But there's a huge spike in buy now, pay later services. In other words, you use your debit card or maybe your credit card, but you spread your payments over, you know, 4, 6, 8 payments. And that's huge. So what people are doing is using more of those facilities, or indeed some cases using payday loans, so very short-term, small amount credit contracts, both of which, of course, are fraught with issues. So payday loans are very expensive, and the buy now, pay later is fine, providing you don't miss a payment. If you miss a payment, you get pinged a big fee. And about 20% of people using buy now, pay later are pinged with a fee. So that's where they make a lot of their money. So we're seeing this really peculiar situation where some people, through desperation, I think, are looking for alternative credit channels. Others are just not borrowing and are paying down debt. And a lot of people are paying down mortgages because they're very concerned about what's happening ahead. And I keep reminding people, you know, if you look at the global financial crisis, look at the US or indeed the UK, the peak fall in home prices and the peak destruction and the peak default rates didn't happen on day one, right? It was actually in year four. So this takes a long time to work through because, you know, firstly, people, when they start struggling, they sort of keep trying to pay, and then they sort of, you know, maybe refinance or restructure. And then once they actually go into default, it takes a long time for the bank to then process that or deal with it, right? And so my expectation is that we are going to see prices still slide, but over the medium term. But default rates will probably rise not this year, but probably 2 or 3 years down the track, which is, my mortgage stress is a leading indicator of trouble because that's telling you about cash flow, right? Just translate that 3 or 4 years forward, and I do expect more defaults. So I think appetite for credit, very low. And that's the point. You can throw more liquidity through the system. You can actually get the rates to be really low. But there is also the demand side, and I don't think the demand there is currently very strong. And by the way, a lot of the government policies are more on the supply side rather than the demand side.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Another thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit on a different topic is the central banks and their move towards potentially a government-sponsored cryptocurrency or digital currency.
Yep.
And I've here in the United States, I think what's going to happen is the Fed will come out. I think we've talked about this, where you have an app and they give you the UBI directly to your app. But more importantly, to do that transfer mechanism, we would all have a bank account at the Fed, just like the commercial banks, where they could take and create the bank reserves. That's really the only thing they can do. And then they deposit those bank reserves directly into your bank account. And then you can spend those bank reserves just like you can normal dollars or Aussie dollars that are in your checking account right now, just with the, you know, you just have the app and you swipe it at Starbucks or whatever. And so then what's happening is they're taking bank reserves and they're turning them into legal tender. And that's, if you look at all the work that Brent Johnson's done and Dr. Lacey Hunt, that's kind of the line in the sand for those guys when they go from being more in the deflationist camp to the inflation camp, or potentially even hyperinflation, when you can start using bank reserves as legal tender. That sounds kind of weird to a lot of people because they assume that the central bank, when they create these bank reserves, well, that just is, that's money. But what they don't realize is they can print all those bank reserves they want, and it's still just, all it does really is add balance sheet capacity to the banking system. And then there needs to be, on the supply side, willingness to lend. And on the demand side, there needs to be a willingness to take out additional debt. But I think that, you know, from a privacy standpoint, there are a lot of issues there from a standpoint of creating more money supply, broad money, and then also velocity. And I know you've given this a lot of thought, so I'd like to get your opinion on this, not only in the United States, but maybe more specifically in Australia.
Well, there's a few interesting observations. Let me start at the end of the story. Today, they've just announced that they're going to invest in additional digital facilities. This is the government, right? So that they can use basically a digital face image by way of ID, right? And that's going to be rolled out more broadly across Australia, right? Now, you know, it doesn't take much to actually think, hang on a moment. So they're going to actually use face recognition as a way to start identifying people. Access to government services is where it's going to start. That's a big deal, right? Because now you've suddenly got an additional direct ability to be able to identify people and associate, you know, a digital profile.
What's their argument for that? Like, what's wrong with a driver's license? Has that worked for quite a while?
Yeah, we've had driver's license and all sorts of things. They're basically saying we can consolidate lots of information into one database, which will be more efficient. We'll be able to provide better access to government services. Sure. But it also means that you're going to be much more trackable. I just think of China, right? What China does is to actually have all these cameras around the place, and they can pretty much track everybody. The second point, so that's a big concern to me. I think that's a big, big red flag, but it looks as though that's what they want to advocate. The second point is that if you think about digital currencies, the Reserve Bank published a paper the other day on what they're thinking about with regard to central bank digital currencies. And they were pretty much sitting on the fence saying, well, you know, there's a few developments around the world, et cetera, et cetera. But there were two observations. The first observation is they made a sort of oblique reference to once, we go into negative interest rates, potentially, a digital currency can be quite helpful in terms of managing the issue. Otherwise, of course, people just take money out of the banks and, negative rates don't work. Now, they did it obliquely. They referred to research relating to it. But the fact they mention it in this paper, I think, is very significant. And that's my second point. I think this digital evolution that we're talking about is directly connected to potential of negative interest rates, controlling access to money and cash, because without it, And there was a paper last year from the IMF saying, you know, global financial crisis, they took rates down, what, 4%, 5% to be able to actually create stimulus. Can't do that now because rates are pretty much at zero, right? But if you can take rates negative, you can get the same bang for your buck. But to do that, you've got to stop people being able to whip cash out of the system, because if they just hold cash out of the system, it won't work. So that, now, associate that with digital and suddenly that. Third point is, you're right. You can create massive amounts of liquidity through the banking system and you can, you know, throw money there. But if it's not actually going into the real economy, it has no impact. And that's one of the reasons why there's a big debate about inflation versus deflation. The only way to actually get money into the real economy is to give it more directly to people who can spend it, which is, you know, normal people, right? And frankly, a lot of the stimulus so far has not been that effective. Now, in Australia, we've had JobKeeper and JobSeeker, which was a government pool of funds, huge liquidity. In fact, the liquidity was equivalent to more than 20% of GDP last quarter. But of course, they're having to pay for that now. And they're ratcheting it down. So the question is, will there be an alternative mechanism to be able to target flow of funds to end consumers for them to use it? And if you're going to do that, then obviously digital is the way to go. And I guess what you could say that this is, you know, the latest incarnation of helicopter money, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And do you think that we could get to a point that if the general population has accounts at the central bank, just like the primary dealer banks and the commercial banks have now, and if they were using those bank reserves or the creation of bank reserves for helicopter money, let's call it, do you think we'd also transition into this world where you're getting your home loan or your car loan from the central bank and not the local retail bank? And if that's the case, what are the lending standards then? Because theoretically, the central bank can take an infinite haircut. And so then, I mean, do we still have lending standards based on credit scores, or now all of a sudden, are lending standards based on a social score?
Well, that of course takes you to where China is, right? Because, you know, social score is pretty critical there. And if you do the wrong thing, your face is there on the system. So basically you can be, you know, you can be tracked suddenly.
Going back to that facial recognition thing, say someone, you know, jaywalks or something like that, or you get pissed off at some guy and you flip them off across the street, and that camera is going to be pointing right at you. And all of a sudden you get a demerit on your social score, and then you can't get that home loan or something. I mean, it's circular.
Yeah. You can certainly build a series of arguments as to how all those things could fit together. The question is, would they do it? Could they do it? Well, they could do it. Would they do it? I think here, my own read of the situation is that the retail banks are such a large part of the economy at the moment that all the strategy has been to support liquidity to the retail banks rather than actually going around them, right?
Right.
And I mentioned this change to the lending standards. My own theory is, as part of the retail banks being allowed to effectively give these repayment holidays, I think there was a quid pro quo done, you know, quietly. So, well, look, we'll deal with responsible lending issues and make it easier for you. I don't see any intent at the moment from the Reserve Bank to start directly injecting liquidity into households now. But again, you got to think down the track, right? You got to think about the capability. Well, yeah, digital face recognition, all those things. And then secondly, what if the money creation processes and yield curve management processes only lead to the same results that they've led to a decade ago? Look at Japan, look at the Eurozone, that didn't work. Yep. Why would this be any different this time? And if that doesn't work, what do they do next?
That's my argument here in the United States. Now I completely agree that the central bankers, including Jerome Powell and the people at the Fed, they really are very reactionary. I don't think they understand the system even as well as we do, as some people here on YouTube. And the guys and gals on FinTwit that I talk to, they probably understand it less, but they're the ones that have all the control mechanisms with the interest rates and the bank reserves. But if they're kind of reacting to this, I would at least give them enough credit to say that they would be cognizant of what happened in Japan. And if they're saying to themselves, okay, Japan tried to create inflation, they didn't. So let's take a few of these 900 PhDs that we have working here at the Fed and have them try to figure out why Japan couldn't create that inflation. And if we need to create inflation here to bail out the government because they're $27 trillion in debt, then how on earth would we do that? And of course, that comes right back to injecting money directly into the system through UBI and making sure that it's got velocity and everything that they need to continue to kick the can down the road. I mean, I'm just thinking that's the end game. And of course, there's no certainties. There are only probabilities. But I mean, if someone just waved the magic wand and said, OK, George Martin, bam, you guys are in charge of Australia, the central bank, and this is your only job to make sure that the housing market stays inflated for as long as possible. And let's say that you and I had no moral compass whatsoever. We had no ethics and we were just completely brainwashed by these globalists or central planners or whatever you want to call them. And we took the job. I mean, if you and I were sitting there just strategizing for a week with a few whiteboards, I mean, that I think that's pretty much where we end up, don't you?
Yeah, I think there are three steps. The first step is a lot of jawboning, right? And you saw that. I mean, the Fed announcement a couple of weeks ago about targeting higher inflation, right? There was nothing new in that statement. They've said it before, yeah. But somehow
expectations.
But it basically, you know, ran away. And I see a lot of that here with the Reserve Bank. They do a lot of jawboning to try and actually do nothing but do something, right? First point. The second point is everyone here, if I talk to people in government and indeed in the regulators and in the banks, are all concerned about house price falls because so much of the value of people's wealth and, of course, the structure of the economy is reliant on home house prices. They've gone way too high. They're 40% over long-term values. They need to find a way to keep them high. And so I've said consistently, you know, two things. One is they're way overvalued. They should come back. Secondly, they'll try and stop them coming back because if they do come back, it's going to be an absolute disaster and people are going to be taken to the cleaners. And frankly, you know, central government and state governments are going to, you know, find it terrible to deal with as well as individuals. So it's almost in everybody's interest to try and keep the Ponzi scheme going. But to make the Ponzi scheme going, you need more people coming in the bottom to be able to actually continue to buy. That's why they're stimulating with first-time buyer grants. Get more people to come in. You can get $50,000 or $55,000 if you're in WA to go buy a homeland package to sort of keep this, feed the beast. I keep saying, feed this beast, right? You've got to keep feeding it, right? But the third point is, if that doesn't work, then, yeah, you've got to actually stand back and think, well, what else can we do? And the only thing I can think of, you know, a bit like what you said, is you can increase the money supply. And in fact, the money supply here in Australia has gone way high relative to previously, but doesn't tell you anything about the velocity of money. And unless you can get money into the hands of people who can spend it, it doesn't make any difference. And household consumption and household confidence is relatively low at the moment. So unless you find a way to change that, you know, it's tough. But here's the point. The government is talking about tax cuts as the next stimulus measure in the budget, which basically will hit the top end of town rather than the bulk of people who actually would spend. Whilst they're talking about scaling back the protection for those who are unemployed. And that, you know, there was a bit of a premium paid to people who are unemployed through COVID. That's being dialed back now. So what we're seeing from government at the moment is standard old-fashioned policies, right, to try and actually do what they did last time around, tax cuts, et cetera, et cetera. Not sure it's going to work. So, yeah, that then leads you to, I need to do something different. And that's where some of the discussions that we've had, obviously, you know, is or should be maybe on the table. It's not necessarily a good thing, by the way. I mean, I come back to this. The more you try and control, the more you try and pull those levers as a central bank or as a, you know, as a government, you know, I think you just end up digging a deeper and deeper hole and you're moving further and further away from capitalism and you end up with a weird, controlled, centralized, digitalized economy where, in fact, you and I are widgets, you know, and we're just there, I guess, you know, paddling our canoe, trying to sort of do what we can do, but, you know, not actually necessarily benefiting from you know, innovation or creativity or those sorts of things. I mean, this is a nightmare, but it's one that's perhaps not that far away.
Do you think, given the choice, that the government there would sacrifice the currency to prop up the housing market?
Pretty much, yes. So the Reserve Bank was talking the other day about, you know, the currency, which is at 72, 73 then, was a bit high. It would be really good if it was lower. Jawboning, remember my strategy? Jawbone first, right? And the currency came down a bit. There was also one of the banks came out and said, well, the Reserve Bank could cut interest rates from 0.25% to 0.1% either October or November, and that took the currency down a bit further. You know, you actually need the currency lower if you're going to be able to import inflation, right? And it also benefits, of course, you know, all of our exports as well. So the currency is probably too high, but fundamentally that goes back to what the Fed is doing and what the US dollar is doing, right? Because if the US dollar remains strong, that's one scenario. If the US dollar goes weaker, that's a different scenario. So in a way, I think Australian currency control is very much on the back of what happens to the US dollar.
I see. Yeah, I was thinking that if what's going through their mind is like, listen, we can do this UBI to prop up the housing market, but that's going to really, our currency is going to tank because we're printing all of these additional currency units, or now we're turning bank reserves into legal tender. Then they'd say, well, you know, here are our choices. Either the Aussie dollar goes to 30 or the housing market crashes. So which do you choose? You know, if you've got to print up that much money. And so that's when, I mean, I think, frankly, the politicians here would choose to keep asset prices inflated, just because, like Australia, the bulk of our consumption here revolves around not only housing, but here revolves around the stock market as well. How does that work in Australia? Do you guys have like what we have here, the 401k? Where a lot of employees, in fact, the good majority of the retirees or people coming into retirement have, I would say, 100% of their net worth divided between their 401k, which is basically stocks, and index funds and ETFs and whatnot, and the equity in their home.
Yeah, well, we have a huge superannuation system in Australia, and basically that was brought in under a Labor government more than 30 years ago. And a lot of people are saving. So if you think about the relativity of assets, there's more in property, but the superannuation sector is the second largest pool. And a lot of that has gone into stocks, other, you know, share options and all sorts of things like that. Most of it's controlled by a small number of large financial companies. Guess what? The same people who own the banks. So
yeah,
we've got
stocks in the banks. That's where the retirement funds are. The stocks in the banks own the mortgages.
That's exactly right. So basically, a lot of the superannuation funds are in our local banks and things like that. Remember that our banks here traditionally have been a very large proportion of the stock market. I mean, way more than in the US. We don't have a very large IT and related, you know, not like you've got with all those Googles and Facebooks. We don't have those. So our stock market is predominantly resource, banks, and a bit of retail and a few other things, right? So there's been a lot there. The other point is quite a lot of those superannuation funds are now being invested offshore because they can't necessarily get the returns in Australia. And that's creating another interesting question with the exchange rate movement and what happens to returns there. So it's a really big deal. And look, the problem I've got, because I still think that the stock market's way overvalued relative to any long-term perspective that I've got in terms of future value of stocks. But you've got basically savings in superannuation. You've got savings in property, right? And that's pretty much it. Now, if either of those go or if both go, then basically the wealth of the country disappears.
In other words, purchasing power. That's correct. Key. Because people, exactly. I think there's a bit of a disconnect. Well, the wealth, who cares? It's just those wealthy fat cats. They don't understand that equals purchasing power for the majority of the population. Yeah.
And the point there is that superannuation is fed into the banking system. The banking system uses those funds to be able to lend. So it's all connected, right? And this is the, I sometimes try and draw a picture for people to show how everything is connected, right? You cannot look at just property. You cannot look at just superannuation. You can't look at just the SME sector, because everything is connected. Just give you a really simple, straightforward example, right? So if you're a property investor and you are getting rental stream from a worker who's in a shop, right? And that worker suddenly finds themselves out of a job, so they can't pay the rent. You can't pay your mortgage to the bank. That investment property suddenly loses value. That property was on a mortgage on the bank's books. So right. Suddenly cash flow is gone. The bank value has gone. And so, you know, this whole thing starts to unwind.
Retirement goes down. Consumption goes down. Jobs go down.
Spiral. And that's the scary thing about this, right? So the problem I've got is often people just take a bit of the puzzle and try and solve a bit of the puzzle, right?
Yeah.
But you got to look at it systemically, right? And then you see that everything is connected. So every time you pull the lever over here, right, something drops off the back of the lorry over there. And that's part of the reason why this is quite complicated to try and deal with. But if you basically just say, well, I'm going to throw more liquidity into the system, that doesn't necessarily give you the right outcomes.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to share with you that I've noticed, I've been in Phoenix just helping out a family member for the last couple of weeks. I'll be here for a couple of months. It wasn't really planned. But I've noticed something very bizarre, and whether I'm going to Whole Foods, like the grocery store, or a coffee shop, or a sandwich shop, something like that, very few of them are giving me change if you use cash. So I've never seen anything like this. So what they'll have is a sign at the cash register that says that the United States has a serious coin shortage. I'm like, okay, I didn't realize, like, why would we have it's not like we use like copper, or it's not like we actually use silver to mint these things. Well, why do we have this big shortage? So what they'll do is they'll say, okay, I'll give you a 20, and let's say you're due back $19 and some change or whatever. Well, they'll say, well, we can give you the 19, but we can't give you any change back because we have this catastrophic change shortage. So then everyone's just using their card. And I'm like, what is going on here? Like, I don't want to put on the tinfoil hat too quickly, but you're like, okay, is this, are we trying to like condition the population to just stop using cash altogether? I mean, have you heard of this?
In Australia, there's definitely a move to use cards, and they're actually using the virus as the excuse, you know, because, you know, if you're using physical stuff, then it's been around, you don't know where it's been. Despite the fact the Reserve Bank actually came out some time ago saying, no, there's no evidence to suggest that the, you know, notes are actually likely to transfer. So that's the first point. So there is a virus thing. And look, in Australia, we've always used the plastic, and we're sort of quite leading adopters of, you know, all of those things. The second point is cash, not in particular coins, is horribly expensive to process, right?
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. So if you're a bank or if you're a shop, you got to deal with all of that. So if they can actually get rid of it completely, they can save a lot of money.
Oh, Samir, they're just using that as an excuse, some sort of shortage that nobody knows about, but you just see it so many times that you just accept that it's real. Just to keep their costs down, yeah.
Yeah, and the final point is, of course, that, you know, if you think about the coins, they're mostly very small in value, and with inflation and the value of things, essentially, you know, the roundings begin to disappear. So, you know, it gets to the point where it's all too much, too hard, too difficult. But in fact, in Australia, they're now taking ATMs out left, right, and center because there's just less demand for notes. You can get notes from supermarkets if you want to when it's part of your transaction, but even in supermarkets they're now encouraging people to use plastic, using the virus as an excuse. I think this is partly, you know, a cost question, but going back to what I said about digital control, you know, if you wanted to have greater control of the economy, then taking notes and coins out of the system and using digital gives you just so much more control. So there is this other thing. And I keep saying we could well be sleepwalking into a digital economy, right? And I think we should preserve the right to use notes and coins because it's legal tender, right? Yeah. But in Australia, a few months ago, there was an attempt to reduce the ability to use notes for transactions above $10,000. We actually fought that because we felt that was actually a removal of a civil liberty. But the fact is that in Australia, more and more people are using, you know, digital, or indeed using a digital wallet on a phone, so they never use anything like a plastic card. They just wave the phone about. And if you think about the demographic shift here, that will definitely happen. Eventually, we will get to the point where the only way to transact will be digitally, either by a phone or with a card. That is the future. No doubt about that.
Okay, I know we're getting short on time, Martin. I'm just looking at the clock here. So I do want to get your thoughts on one thing before we let you go. And here in the United States, I don't know if you've been following it, but I think we're in an auto loan bubble as well. And I remember when I was, you know, kind of a teenager in the late 1980s and 1990s, and I actually had to ask my mom about this the other day, because I'm like, am I remembering this right? I could have sworn that the typical car loan, I thought the max car loan was 36 months. And most people would pay cash. But if you couldn't pay cash, if you had to take out a loan and do the financially, you know, crazy thing at the time, you know, back then, you wanted to have as little debt as possible. And you wanted to, you know, people who took out a car loan, you're like, oh, you're making a bad financial decision. But nowadays, you just max it out. But my point is that the kind of the max car loan is about 36 months, which made sense because cars depreciate so quickly. You don't want to get upside down. But now, I mean, I was just in Vegas visiting my mom, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, something like that. I'd been out of the United States for a long time, with the exception of a little quick stint in Florida before I went to St. Bart's. And I was noticing these billboards that were advertising like 7-year car loans for 7 years. And I said, what is going on here? And it goes back to your whole extend and pretend philosophy with Australia. I think they're doing that here in the United States. And I know they've been doing this for quite some time. This is nothing new. But I think they went from 3-year to 5-year. Now, all of a sudden, they're at 7-year. And you think about the interest rate there as well. Back when I was talking about this time frame, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you would have had a 3-year car loan at like, what, 10% interest? Something like that. Think about what your car payment would be compared to now, where you get a car loan at, let's say, 1% interest for 7 years. And you look around, like foreigners come to the United States. I know, you know, people that I know in Colombia and Ecuador and whatnot, and they land in Texas or Florida or Arizona or wherever, and they look around at all the cars that they see driving around, and like, my gosh, these Americans are rich. Everyone's driving a BMW. Everyone's driving a Mercedes or a Porsche. But they don't realize that guy that's driving the brand new Porsche, his monthly payment is like $200 a month, you know, because of this crazy loan. I wanted to get your thoughts on that and if they're doing that in Australia.
Yeah, well, they certainly are. So there's a big uptake on cars, and particularly at the moment, what's called utes. They're the sort of the,
truck thing.
Yeah, exactly right. Here's the point. Financial organizations want certain cash flow over as long a period of time as they can get it, right? They actually want people to go on paying and paying and paying and paying because they can monetize those cash flows, right?
Yeah.
So in other words, the debt story for a financial services organization isn't so much about repaying the loan and getting rid of it, right? The debt story for them is continue to get people to pay and pay and pay and pay, right? It's about cash flow. And that's what people have forgotten in all of this. That's why in the current environment, the environment is one where low interest rates are there, big debt is there. The financial system loves that, right? But we are cannon fodder as a result of that, because actually you end up never paying it off, right? And right. I'm old-fashioned. I mean, I have to say this, I'm old-fashioned. For me, whenever I have debt, I want to get rid of it as quickly as I can because I hate that liability. But I'm the exception, right? Younger people in particular who've been brought up in this environment, you know, are just used to having high levels of debt. And I've had a number of people in my surveys say, so far as I'm concerned, I don't care about repaying the capital. I'll just continue to cycle it through, pay the minimum all the way through. Interest rates are really low. Now's the time to get as much as I can to bring forward, you know, get me that car and get everything else. That's the philosophy that we've got. And of course, that is based off two things. Firstly, the cash flow from a financial perspective, from the financial sector, but the other is the marketing, right? And we are now in a marketing-led environment where everybody wants everything. You know, you get all these messages through social media and on TV and everything else. And instant gratification is what it's about. Now, are those values good values? No. Are those actually sustainable long-term? Probably not. But that's where we are at the moment. And I come back to the fundamental philosophical point that we've got a society that is based on instant gratification, on debt any way you like it, be it cars or whatever, right? Or be it property or whatever. And we are actually sucked into this now. So we become the cogs in the financial machine, the cogs in that marketing-led financial machine. And like it or not, that's the world we're in. Now, you know, we can push against it and say, hang on a moment, we should change it. And I do try and raise people's awareness of debt isn't always good, but I tell you, I'm uphill.
Yeah, that's for sure. Same here, buddy. All right. Well, another fantastic conversation, Martin. I just so enjoy our time on through Skype or Zoom or whatever. For all of my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, your YouTube channel, your website, where can they go to check that out?
Yeah, well, so the YouTube channel is called Walk the World, and we run daily shows there on finance and property and all things related. And digitalfinanceanalytics.com blog is where I also blog on a regular basis. So you can find me there and also on Twitter as well.
All right, Martin, I appreciate your time. I can't wait to do it again, buddy.
Enjoyed it. Thanks. As always, take care.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.